morning. Welcome to this third annual Profound Treasury Retreat. And we're now beginning our study period. Welcome, retreatants, and welcome, online folks. It is an honor to be here with all of you, and so inspiring that people are willing to take time, valuable time from your lives, to spend studying and practicing and accomplishing the Buddha Dharma. To begin with, it's good to note why we're all here. You may wonder why you're here. I sometimes wonder why I'm here. But I think we're all here because of some connection to one another, and also due to the great Buddha activity and benevolence of the great Vijayadhara, Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Each of us, in one way or another, has a personal connection with the dharmic energy that Trungpa Rinpoche set in motion. Some people never met the Vijayadhara in person, but they are meeting the Vijayadhara. They're meeting him. And oddly and amazingly, after teaching between 1970 and 87 in North America, the ripples of the Buddha activity energy continue to flow. And I think that is a sign of a great master, that their energy continues to flow out and touch people. Not indirectly, not from afar, but very directly, right into the heart and core. Last year, we had a little talk in our program by Dzigar Khongtrul Rinpoche, who arrived somehow. And he was talking about the idea of some people feel they've missed the boat, and that's kind of deluded, and some people think they were on the boat, and that's also deluded. Basically, we're all blessed to be here. We're the recipients. We're like the caught on a hook of compassion. We're caught on a hook of compassion. For some reason, something has been awakened in us before we even begin. Something has been awakened in us. Maybe a word, maybe an image, maybe a video, maybe a tape, maybe a single paragraph or one particular book. Something, it's not so much the books are so amazing, but they touch something within us that is eager and ready to blossom, to emerge. And that's really what the Dharma is all about. It's bringing something to life that we get a glimpse of, we have a suspicion about, we touch from time to time, but somehow doesn't always feel accessible or really flourishing. And we want more. We want to develop. We want to grow. We want to realize and to be of greater benefit to ourselves and other beings. So this talk is called Basic Training. I called it Basic Training, and then I thought I should call it Basic Training That Never Ends. That many times you think we'll just do basic training and then we'll go on to the main show, or we'll see the opening act, where we won't really be there because we're just waiting for the main star to appear. Sometimes people think of the path like that. There's the everybody wants to be advanced. As Vijayadara said in his talk last night, everyone wants to have a PhD, but nobody wants to learn the alphabet or even know how to wipe their bottom. So basic training that never ends. So these retreats, of course, are based on the teachings of the profound, brilliant Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche, and particularly focused on the writings in the three volumes of the profound treasury of the Ocean of Dharma, as well as other teachings within his opus of works. In particular, we need to recognize that the teachings found in these books came from a particular setting, a particular context, in particular the 13 years of Vajradhatu seminaries. There were 3-month training programs, of which Trungpa Rinpoche was extremely proud of the format that he developed for those programs. They alternated periods of sitting meditation and periods of study, with the main course taught by himself and other arrays of courses taught by his students. So there are two interesting things right from the start that he emphasized, that it's important to join study and practice. Without practice, study is just kind of amusement, entertainment of your mind. It's not transformative. And practice without study can just be kind of dull and vague and not that helpful. So alternating study, intensive study and intensive practice was a new form, unlike forms that were common in Tibet. In particular, the emphasis on sitting practice and group sitting practice was unique among Tibetans teaching in the West. It was heavily influenced by the Zen tradition in the U.S. The notion of seshin was actually the term we used of a group sitting, and they saw the value of that for training of the Western minds. The other thing, in terms of the context of the Vajradhatu seminaries, is that every single seminary was based on what's called Lamrim, L-A-M-R-I-M, Lamrim, stages of the path, a map of the journey for a practitioner from beginning to end. So you could say the teachings focused on the practical, what would be useful if you wanted to take a gorilla and make them into a Buddha. So beginning with the gorillas, ending up with Buddha, what's the recipe? What are the stages? What are the you need to do? So in particular, as the three volumes make evident, the seminaries were based on a progression from Hinayana to Mahayana to Vajrayana, three main stages of the path, yana being vehicle. So vehicle means what can transport us forward. So there's some kind of movement and development in our life, understanding in our practice. Sort of think of them as concentric circles in a way, Hinayana being the core, the Mahayana expanding, and the Vajrayana kind of exploding. They're also sometimes compared to building the foundation of a house. You build a strong foundation, then you can put up the walls, and then finally you can put on a golden roof on top, and you have a solid structure. Over the years, I've gone to appreciate more and more how much emphasis the Vidyadhara put on creating a foundation, to knowing something about the fundamentals of the Buddhist path, to knowing the importance of the Mahayana, and to go slowly and methodically. Became very clear to me as I began to study and practice that this was not a quick thing, that it was actually a way of life, a way of life that's kind of ever unfolding and enriching, but doesn't really have a particular end point. Well, now I'm over it. Now I'm there, wherever there is. And that whole notion wasn't quite the point, because as we go into the Vajrayana more and more, you'll see there is no there there. There is no nothing there. It's here. That's it. That's all. So that is where the Dharma can happen. I'll talk a little bit today about foundational, important teachings and practices in the Hinayana and Mahayana that will make us easier to really reap the benefits of the Vajrayana. I wanted to introduce one more term, though. So there's Hinayana, the narrow vehicle, Mahayana, the great vehicle, Vajrayana, the adamantine vehicle, diamond vehicle, otherwise known as Tantra. Another term, though, is Ekayana, E-K-A-Y-A-N-A, Ekayana. And that means one. There's basically only one path, and just looking at it from different angles. It's one journey. It's not that you... It's not like school, you know, where you graduate grade 3 and then you can go grade 4. It's kind of different than that. So, in terms of the Ekayana, and there are certain principles that go through all the yanas. So, what are we doing all together? Well, we're working with our minds. We're working with our emotions. We're working with our way of being in the world, our relationship to other beings. We're working with our relationship with the environment. We're stepping back and taking a look at our life. We're willing to step back, interrupt the momentum. There's incredible momentum, I think, as you know. Incredible momentum in just regular life, you know. There's endless things always to do, and there's endless opportunities to feel behind on every little thing, like emails. They just keep coming. I don't know who thought of them and why they thought it was a good idea. But it's like once you start, they just rain down, and like a stream of them, and it, like, feel buried, and you just got to go spend, you know, going to spend half an hour just like delete, 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 delete. Oh, oops, I deleted the wrong one. Delete, 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 like that. And then there's like schedule books, and they get filled up with all those little squares in each day, and they get filled up with things, and it's very rare to actually be able to step back and, you know, think what we're doing. We could just like blast right through and never have a thought about it, like skim through on the surface of things, because we'll not run out of things to do or things to think or dramas to have. That'll never stop. So it's so precious that we have this opportunity to sometimes like step back and think, wait a minute, you know, is this what it's about? And then I just, after I finish my, send my last email, do my last meeting, and then I keel over and die. It's possible to do that, very possible. And it's a little bit sad, I think. So that's what we're doing. We're kind of taking a look at ourselves, our relation to others, our relation to phenomena. And this is sometimes called going back to square one. We're also, by saying that, taking a step back and looking at our lives, I want to emphasize how personal the Dharma is. It's not a subject that's external to kind of, digest and regurgitate, although it is good to try to understand it. But it really comes alive at the very personal, at the felt level. It's a felt level. It's not simply a conceptual. It's not based on cleverness. You can't get ahead by cleverness alone. It takes digestion. So there's a lot of guidelines before I launch into actually talking about Hinayana and Mahayana and doing some practices together. The guidelines for how to practice and how to study in general, and how to practice is to not overthink it, to be simple and wholehearted. The Vidyadhara has said, it's not how much practice you do, it's how genuinely you relate to it, how wholehearted you are. And in terms of study, the usual is talked about, how do you study this kind of material? It's kind of like studying everything. There's that, trying just to understand it. And that's called hearing, traditionally. It's just trying to figure out, what does this term mean? What are some of the key topics and of the talk? And just what we're used to, just trying to follow the logic, etc. But that's just a very outer level of study. That's just a starting point, although it's important. The second aspect traditionally of the three is contemplating. So it's hearing and contemplating. And by contemplating, that is taking the subject and applying it to your life, testing it against your own experience and judgment, seeing, well, how true or untrue it is, how it might be expressed in various ways, how it might arise in the midst of circumstances of your life. It's really wrestling with the material and chewing on it and investigating it and not skimming over it. You have the term, and then you move on without really letting it, depths of that term begin to resonate somehow. So it's called contemplating. So it's not just musing about it, but it is mixing it up, I could say, mixing it up with the topic. Sometimes you can tell a little bit about your understanding. You should test your understanding over and over again. That's part of contemplating, testing your understanding. Especially as if you've heard topics many, many times, it's good to come back and say, well, do I really understand this? Do I have any clue why I'm doing this? I've heard it a million times, but what is it really? Why of all the various things could be said within a tradition, are these things said? And what's not being said, and why is that? What's being emphasized, and what isn't, and why? At one point, Trungpa Rinpoche said that a good way to test your understanding of Dharma is, can you explain what you're doing to your grandmother? Because it's very easy to have a lot of terms and a lot of lists and bells and whistles But then there's no boat under which the bells and whistles are whistling around. You know, there's no weight to that information. It's a facile. It's glib. So we should always question ourselves, especially when we start talking to other people, and then we find ourselves, we said all this stuff, and then we think, that was BS. I have no clue what I'm saying, you know. And that's always an interesting point. The third in this trio, hearing, contemplating, and meditating. Meditating in this particular instance doesn't refer just to sitting practice or other practices. It means there's a stage reached where there is no longer even a hair breadth of separation between the topic of the Dharma and your own being. It's completely part of your gristle and your bones and your lymph and your blood flow. Is not a question of trying to remember and then repeat, but it's coming directly from your experience. You actually see it, you actually feel it, you actually know it in a different way totally. So that's the approach to study, approach to practice, simple approach to study, really working with the material, questioning, being inquisitive, being critical, not being afraid to say the wrong thing, not being afraid to be honest about your confusion or your doubt. There's no way to kind of go through the hearing, contemplating, meditating as though you're putting like frosting on a cake and then presenting a good appearance. So a couple of other just general themes throughout what we'll be doing and terms that you may need to know. One of them is the term Xinjiang, S-H-I-N-J-A-N-G, Xinjiang. And that has different translations, but one of them is being thoroughly processed. Processed is sort of like, I know, Velveeta, you know, something like that. There's the notion that what we're doing, we're actually processing ourselves. We're obviously going through a process, which means processing. And there's a sense of almost like if you take a bunch of pebbles and put them into those rock tumbler things, and they kind of bang around and they keep making a lot of noise, and they bang and bang and bang bang, and they come out really shiny and beautiful little polished stones. So in some ways we're polishing ourselves, like from our pebbly nature, we're polishing and shining it. Sometimes this quality of Xinjiang being processed is described as both harsh and gentle. There's kind of a harsh quality to being a little pebble flopping around with like rough grit to become shiny little stones. At the same time, there's a gentle quality because then you're all smooth and nice at the end. So the quality of Xinjiang, sometimes the Dharma can feel very harsh, and we'll talk more about that. It's also very, very gentle. It's taming, but in order to tame, we have to face certain things. And one more kind of general theme, kind of setting the stage for what we're doing to keep in mind. And it came up in the talk, in the video as well, is the notion of theism and non-theism, theism and non-theism. And that becomes extremely important when we get into the Vajrayana, but it's important all along. And it's a subtle thing. I mean, it's not mainly designed to describe different spiritual traditions. It's mainly pointing to different states of mind. The theistic mentality is that part of us that wants to be spoon-fed, that wants to be saved, that keeps feeling that we're not adequate, so we need to kind of find something or somewhere out there to say, there, everything's okay, I'll take care of it, blah, blah, blah. It's the kind of hope for escape, hope for salvation, etc. And the non-theism is the more bare ground where we're thrown back on ourselves. And this comes up in the way Vijayadhara talks about refuge vow, for instance, is becoming a refugee. We think refuge, oh yeah, everyone's going to take care of me. No, it's refuge is becoming like a refugee. You're on your own. So the Buddha Dharma, the Buddhist path is very much of something that you do. And no one can do for you. And no one will do exactly the same way. There's lots of guidelines. There's lots of skillful means and methods and insights. And then the rest is up to you, what you do with it. That's a non-theism. So I wanted to review the first two yanas. How many people have studied the first volume? Excellent. How many have studied the second volume? Great. So this is like a review. And if you haven't, it would be less of a review. I guess. Some people don't like the Hinayana. And I do. I like it. What I like about it is that it is so honest and straightforward. Hinayana means narrow vehicle, but not in the sense of narrow-mindedness, but in the sense of paring down to essentials. In talking about the three yana journey, it's also important to note that it's not talking about the schools of Buddhism that also sometimes labeled Hinayana, and that's viewed as kind of a negative term. This is talking about a stage of a path. And I've pointed out many, many times the whole notion of the three yana journey is a Vajrayana concept. It's all part of that ekayana, you know. It's not saying there's that journey and there's that journey. This is one journey. This is how it starts. So you might reflect on how your journey starts. What is the started it? Did it have a start? What is the starting point? I said the starting point is your own self. With basic questions, who are you? You know, what are you doing with your life? What is this life about? What is our actual experience? And there it becomes very nitty-gritty, very grounded. It's not at all a dreamy jhana. It's saying if you're going to think of other realities, you're going to think of other ways of being, you have to first have some clue of what's going on right now with you. Sometimes this is talked about in terms of the idea of self-reliance. Sometimes it's talked about in terms of focus on what's called the relative truth, ordinary everyday experience that we have. We can't bypass that. A lot of times we would like to bypass that because it's kind of a drag sometimes. But it said, no, you can't bypass that. You have to start with that. So another thing in terms of the seminary teachings and the Profound Treasury teachings, every year, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, every year, Hinayana, Mahayana, Vajrayana, always came back to Hinayana and built from there. Like combing your hair from the roots to the ends. He also always presented within each jhana the teachings in terms of three basic principles. One is called Shila, which means discipline. One is called samadhi, which means meditation, and one is called prajna, which means insight, knowledge, or direct intuitive perception. So in looking at your path or your practice, it's also good to have those three principles in mind, you know, as you go through your day. What is your behavior? You know, what is your view of what you're doing? And where is the awareness and mindfulness in it? Each of them kind of poses a question. It's like, you know, like those little blinkers. Is the prajna flickering? Is this Shila kind of, you know, dimmed out? Where is the samadhi? You don't know. So those three are very, very important. So I'm going to review a little bit each of the Hinayana and Mahayana from that viewpoint. And I'm going to start with the prajna and the Hinayana. Prajna is like, you could talk about it as some of the view or the principles or the outlook or whatever in the Hinayana, some of the key points. When the Buddha attained enlightenment, sitting under the tree in Bodh Gaya, his very first formal teaching was on what is called the Four Noble Truths. Four Noble Truths. He could have talked about anything, but that's what he decided to talk about very first. Interesting, yeah. And at one point, Trungpa Rinpoche said, if you could understand the first noble truth, it would be amazing. Something, oh yeah, Four Noble Truths, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, he said, nobody is willing to actually look at the first noble truth. And Barry touched on that a little bit in his introduction to the sadhana of Mahamudra. But in fact, this world is completely filled with suffering. If you... I think sometimes here we are, you know, you look around the room, you know, here we are in the middle of North America somewhere and having the, you know, incredible privilege of being able to come to something like this, to have the time, the money, the circumstances. It's amazing that we're here. And sometimes when people talk about the first noble truths in this kind of setting, people think of, you know, psychological distress and, you know, difficulty with their little relationships and whatever, their feelings of inadequacy or hate, self-hatred, or their this or that, problems with their parents or the various little things. But I think in the it may be hard in this kind of bubble of North Americanness within our globe to really get at what this is talking about. This is talking about war and oppression and poverty. And I mean, all you need to do is read a few papers to get some sense, I think it's important to do, of what most people are dealing with nowadays. Slavery. Slavery is a huge thing. Human trafficking. The way women are treated around the world is horrific. There are wars all the time, everywhere. Everywhere. There are people who, many, many people, dying needlessly for having not enough food. There are people whose education is just shot. They're in a war zone. They start the school, and then there's no school. And then years later, they're supposed to have to figure out how to deal with their life. And I read that even plants have wars. I used to think plants were kind of benevolent. They just sort of sit there and grow. But they sent out, like, chemicals to kill the other plants around them. And at the slightest opportunity, they invade and take over territory. There's wars and conflict and heartbreak and real suffering. And it doesn't seem that it's ever not been, as far as I know. And that reality, sometimes it's hard to take, actually. You know, I find it hard to take. And a teacher that I admire a lot, Joanna Macy, who's a long-time environmentalist and Buddhist, and she deals a lot with the question of despair, because even if you're not in the situation, just knowing how much can we allow ourselves to know what's happening in the world and how we're benefiting from the suffering and oppression of other people. You know, it's the reality. You know, you buy your little thing. What has that actually come from? Who actually, was enslaved to make a little gadget or this or that? You know, so there's a sense of trying to, as a first noble truth, is like opening ourselves to be pretty clear-eyed. It's not the same as having a guilt trip or just feeling, you know, we should beat ourselves up because we happen to be so lucky it is to be here. At the same time, we can't pretend that everything's just hunky-dory. And so the first noble truth, he said, well, reality is there's a lot of suffering. There's a lot of suffering. The samsara is endless. You know, we just sort of run around, cycle around different realms, you know. So even in, and the thing is, it's even in the most fortunate circumstances, even then there's suffering. I know some people seem to have everything, and we all want to be like them. We don't have everything too, until you actually talk with them, and then they say, oh my God, things always are falling apart. And it's so difficult in every realm. And it goes on and on. Because the first noble truth is not just about humans, it's about animals as well. And to think about that for very long, that's difficult too. But it's a reality. Can we be in reality? Can we start with just reality without shying away? That takes a big step. So I think that's interesting. First noble truth. And fortunately, it's not the only one. But the two kind of bad guys and two good guys, I suppose you could say. The second noble truth is this Well, there's a lot of lot behind all this. There's a kind of a swirling ground of ignorance and denial and just stupidity. Not wanting to see, fundamentally taking the mistaken view that we're the center of everything, and therefore having a sense of alienation, or alienation between self and other, self and environment, a big split view. We need to have that kind of split view in order to do all the devastating things we do. If we actually felt a sense of non-duality, then we wouldn't be trashing the environment, because it would be trashing our own selves. We have to feel other. You have to feel other from our environment, from our world, in order to cause the kind of chaos that we tend to cause. It's like almost a self-protective thing, but it's also a campaign of alienation, isolation. And once that system is set up, as you can study in the Hinayana volume in detail, then what's called a poisonous kind of emotional patterns come up. There is like fed by this basic duality, by this split. So, you know, some of the problems come up because of greed. Everybody wants limited resources, but that becomes very closely connected with aggression. Well, how am I going to get those resources? You guys have it and I don't. So I'm going to have to go take it, and you're going to fight me, and we're going to have a war. A passion, wanting to hold on to what we have, not wanting anyone else to take it away. There's a continual kind of fuel of the various kleshas that keep us struggling. Struggling is the nature of samsara. We have something, we struggle to keep it. We don't have something, we struggle to get it. We want people nearby, we struggle to draw them in. We're tired of them, we struggle to get rid of them. Whatever. Struggle, struggle, struggle. So, there's a third noble truth, is that we don't have to do that. It's the reality of possibility of cessation. I mean, I think when we begin to take a look at things, it just feels overwhelming, like we're just sort of stuck and there's nothing to be done. Very easy to feel that way about pretty much everything. But the I suppose you could say it's a goad, or it could be it could be inspiring, or it could be provocative, is the notion of, well, suggesting that we mutually create this experience, and each of us has a role in contributing to this big mess. And the notion is, and you can't cop out with the excuse that that's just the way it is. That's just the way I am. That's just the way, just the way it is. Okay, enough to go on to something else. They know, well, actually, some part of us is awakened. It's so important in the third noble truth, the notion, suspicion, that the things that really are so painful and difficult, we don't have to do them. We don't actually have to do them. We have the potential to do otherwise. So the notion of cessation. Um, And of course, this is being taught by the Buddha in that case, not me. And so they actually give some example that that's actually possible. Someone's demonstrating, manifesting that it's possible not to buy into this whole system. And the fourth noble truth, so important, is there's a practice, there's a path, there's a kind of a map that was generously laid out that people can have some tools to say, okay, I know it's a mess. I know I have glimpses all the time that I don't need to be caught up, but it's not always obvious how to get from here to there. Sometimes it just makes you feel worse. I'd rather just not know there's any other option. There's an image of if you grow up in a slum, you see children in a slum or whatever, and they never go more than two blocks this way or that way, and that's the reality, and they're perfectly fine until somehow they take the wrong bus. They end up in the fancy area of town. Suddenly they feel really bad. They say, oh, I didn't know there was, you know, all that. So we're like that. We're like in a slum. And this third noble truth, suddenly we see, you know, there's Park Avenue or something like that. Huh, I didn't know about that. You know, how come I'm not there? And what do I have to do? And so there's that notion of the path. And the quality of that path is multi-fold, and I won't talk too much about it since I'm just reviewing, but basically it means working with your mind. There's tremendous respect for the power of how we think about things, and so a lot of change has to happen, begin there. A lot of things we do are because of our false perceptions, our false interpretations, the colorations and distortions. So the starting point in a path is really looking at that, beginning to have a sense of, do we really know how we think about things? And when we see how we think about things, do they seem to have make any sense? Are we just seeing our own projections? So, keep track of time. Yeah. Okay. A couple of, I guess I won't say anything more. That's really the key of view in the Hinayana that you should all know and respect. And of course, there's many others. I'll just label them, jog your memory of teachings on the, it's called egolessness, but that sounds kind of overly philosophical perhaps, but the notion of no self, that what seems to be so solid and real is questionable. That there's no, that we live in a vast web that's totally interdependent, and that everything we do registers and has an effect, karma. The practice emphasis, that was all prajna. Practice emphasis in the narrow Hinayana path is on shamatha and vipassana, as you know. Briefly, shamatha is the calming and focusing of the mind. And that's what many people mistake for meditation altogether, is just getting calm, take a chill pill. But it's tied directly with the vipassana, clear seeing, which is clarifying the mind, brightening the mind and relaxing the mind outward. And finally, there's discipline. It's important to always have these three in mind, because meditation can't just be totally extracted from the prajna and sila. Discipline in the Hinayana fundamentally is one of restraint. It's not doing everything you think of doing. It's a sense of, it's kind of embodied in the whole sitting posture. You know, you're just still. You're not being drawn out every which way by your senses. You're refraining from a lot of things you might consider doing, such as killing, stealing, lying, those kind of things. So there's a sense of, you could say, paring down, and I could leave it with a question of what's really essential, you know, as a human experience. How close are we to our immediate experience as it arises? Can we be there in a dispassionate way without struggle? With some kind of clarity and insight. So I wanted to also review a little bit about the Mahayana. The Hinayana, again, is the ground. We go back to it over and over again. There are times we really need restraint, and there are times we need to let loose. The Mahayana is kind of a natural outgrowth from the Hinayana. We find, oddly, that when you simplify and pare down and come into some kind of presence, that something begins to kind of pull you out, pull you outward. There's kind of a birth or a fertile kind of uprising of interest in the world. Previously, we weren't really able to see much of the world because the world was us. That was our entire preoccupation and pretty much. So when there's begin to settle down, relax that sense of self-absorption, then the world becomes brighter and more interesting, and we begin to really take an interest. And there's also a kind of interesting arising because of being so nitty-gritty and no-nonsense, no BS right here and now, this is what's happening right in front of me, right here. Something arises as something romantic arises. There's a sense of kind of a surprising warmth and interest in others and in the environment and in everything, the objects of our world. So that stream compassionate or loving energy has been kind of plugged up, you know, because we're so preoccupied with our own little thingies. So when we have little gaps and preoccupation kind of loosens or is not working completely, then there's a whole other, much bigger world that kind of displays itself and captures our attention. So Mahayana means big. There's a sense of expansion. you can narrow down and there's a natural expansion. It's kind of like an in-breath and then an out-breath. Because the in-breath, the ground is so pure and so solid, then the expansion can be so much more. So in terms of Shila, Samadhi, and Prajna, in the Mahayana, just touch on them. The view of the Prajna is one of emptiness and compassion. And that's said to be the shocking quality of Mahayana. But there's a quality of discovery of what is called bodhicitta. The mind of awake. And traditionally, the discovery of bodhicitta is so important, again, as a ground for going into the Vajrayana. It said that this possibility of awakening, this kind of opening of the heart, comes as a bit of a surprise, and it comes right in the midst of all our confusion, right where we don't usually look. So it's both the nitty-gritty of samsara, and then the Mahayana says, wait a minute, there's this whole other thing happening, but it's in the same place. This other thing happening is bodhicitta, and it's right here, right in the middle of all this. The practice in the Mahayana builds completely on the ground of shamatha vipassana. But there's a greater emphasis on the post-meditation and practice in life, in midst of activity. The emphasis is on lojong, mind training, and on tonglen, the practice of exchanging self and others. And there are many, many practices, all based on arousing compassion, ventilating, circulating the energy so that we become able to manifest power of compassion, kindness, and love without being in any way depleted. Tapping into boundless energy of awakened kindness. You'll hear more about this, and we'll be doing Tonglen, which you probably all have done. Powerful Mahayana practice. And of course, in terms of Shila, the image of the Bodhisattva is that being not afraid to mix it up with anything in life in terms of cultivating wisdom and compassion. The Bodhisattva image of a Bodhisattva warrior is not holding back for some special, perfect situation, but just launching into whatever situation is there, seeing as fertile ground for awakening everywhere, in the difficult things and in the ecstatic things, challenging things, doesn't matter. Dirty, clean, doesn't matter. And that's what's so cool about working with paramitas and working with the slogan practice. The Bodhisattva actually, a lot of times people try not to make mistakes, but the Bodhisattva says that's where everything's really happening, man. That's where the mistakes is, that's where you're the best fertile ground is. So there's a quality of not only expanding a sense of what practice is, but also expanding your sense of what teaching is out there, broadening that, seeing it, more of it, and having less sense of limit of what is or is not practice. So in the Hinayana, really clear distinction, what's to be cultivated and what's not to be cultivated, samsara and nirvana, what's good, what's bad. And that's important. Otherwise, a Mahayana could seem kind of dreamy and wishy-washy. At the same time, it's very romantic. It's very kind of infused with a kind of energy and lightness. Light and warm energy. So, here we are with the ground of Hinayana and Mahayana generously provided. In the ground of mutual practice, generously provided by you. And tomorrow we'll launch into the opening into the precious Vajrayana. And I guess we have run out of time. As I know, there's a food coming up. The precious Foodayana is about to arrive. And in subsequent talks, there'll be a lot of time for dialogue. But I wanted to make sure that we reviewed before we moved forward and that you appreciated. And I, it's so difficult to lay out just the basics in such a galloping fashion. So please accept my apologies for that. But I wanted all these ideas and this structure of things to be rattling around in your minds and taking root there when you come back and in your discussions. So thank you. Do we dedicate the merit? By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy wrongdoing from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. By the confidence of the golden sun of the great east, may the lotus garden of the Rigdon's wisdom bloom. May the dark ignorance of sentient beings be dispelled. May all beings enjoy profound, brilliant glory.